TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. NATO's Russia-Ukraine Crisis. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson and Professor David Gibbs.
Russia has a long-standing grievance against NATO going back to the year 1990. The history really is very important here, certainly important to the Russians, and it's important we know about it. Specifically, at that time, the Cold War was effectively ended, and the U.S. Secretary of State assured the Russian leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, that NATO would not expand, quote, one inch to the east, all right? This was not informal. Now, many U.S. officials tried to downplay this and insisted it was a casual comment. It was not a casual comment. George Washington University's National Security Archive has made a lot of the documents available, publicly available on this issue. You can find it at the National Security Archive website. And these documents leave no doubt that the American assurances to Gorbachev were made multiple times at multiple levels, not only by American officials, but also German officials, and that this was part of a quid pro quo. The United States would agree not to expand NATO in exchange. The Soviet Union, it was then the Soviet Union, of course, would agree to allow the reunification of Germany. Germany was at the time about to reunify East, would join West. And it required Russian approbation at the UN Security Council, where the Soviet Union had a veto. The Soviet Union agreed, as part of this deal, to drop its objections to German reunification. And, you know, they did not vote against it. Germany was reunified. And we now know from the declassified documents, the entire time that this was happening, the United States was planning to basically expand into Eastern Europe. And it does look from the declassified documents like there was a measure of bad faith on the part of the United States.
That was Professor of History at the University of Arizona, David Gibbs. He joined the effort by Roots Action to explain Russia's long-standing issue with NATO. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was created in 1949 by the United States, Canada, and several Western European nations. Their goal was, in their own words, to provide collective security against the Soviet Union. On February 6, 2022, the Coalition for Peace Action held a webinar on peaceful alternatives in the Russia-Ukraine-NATO crisis with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Wilkerson is former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. Since January 2006, he has taught government and public policy at the College of William and Mary. He is welcomed by Reverend Robert Moore, who has served as Executive Director of the Coalition for Peace Action since 1981.
We are so honored and blessed to have Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson as our speaker. He is a critic of U.S. foreign policy surrounding the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, Iran, and the new Cold Wars with China and Russia, and asserts that the U.S. is not a democracy, but a war state that forces its will on the global community. At this time, many of us are very concerned about what's happening in Ukraine and Russia and the whole region. The title of his talk today is Why All the Fuss About NATO? Colonel Wilkerson.
Well, thank you, Reverend Moore, and thank you for having me back. You're a glutton for punishment. One can't talk about this issue or these issues without really going back to the administration that I kind of got my feet wet in, H.W. Bush's administration. End of the Cold War, halcyon times, as I look back on, right before General Powell died, we were remarking in an email with one another about how things had gone astray. Here we were in 1992, 1993, with the Cold War over. Powell and Bush did not want to be triumphant. They did not want to beat Mikhail Gorbachev into the ground. They didn't want to say, oh, man, we beat you. There were people like that, though, believe me. There were people we're now seeing arrayed around Donald Trump and elsewhere in the Republican Party who wanted to beat Gorbachev to death. They wanted to triumph, put track shoes on, and walk on the Soviets. George H.W. Bush didn't want to do that. He was very humble about it at first. He got a little bit recalcitrant himself toward the end of his tour. But here we are in this period when we are saying, okay, Russia, you can be an observer to both a political and the military alliance called NATO, and eventually you could be a member. So let's work towards that. And Gorbachev went along with it. His foreign minister, Edvard Shevardnadze, went along with it. And Yeltsin, when he replaced him, went along with that. Things were looking pretty good. Then let's come up to 1994, when William Jefferson Clinton needs to get reelected and is not exactly sure he's going to get reelected. What does he do with his foreign policy? He suddenly becomes a very ardent campaigner and advocate for NATO expansion. Well, what had been a very careful process up to then, that is to say, we would do something, we would ask them if they approved. They would do something, they would ask us if we approved. And we would go slowly along, looking at what might be possible with an eye on Russia and they with an eye on us the whole time. That's when we went back to the Open Skies Treaty, which Eisenhower had originally wanted to do in the very beginning of the Cold War, where we could fly over each other's countries and so forth and look and make sure what we were doing and make sure we weren't lying to one another. So this changed gradually as Bill Clinton decided that his policy thereafter was going to be a very vigorous NATO expansion program. And let's fast forward to today and let me ask you a fundamental question, which I asked in a German interview yesterday with a group in Berlin. I think it's fair to say they were sort of thunderstruck when I posed the question to them because they hadn't even thought of it. And I gave it to him. How do you deal with the most important and the most unique component of NATO if you're going to expand like this? And if you know anything about NATO, you know precisely what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Article 5. What is Article 5? An attack on one is an attack on all. Think about that for a moment, as I said to Berlin's audience. Think about that. That means that the person in Peoria, the person in the desert towns in Nevada, wherever they might be in America, is willing to risk nuclear war over Lithuania, over Latvia, over Estonia, over Ukraine, if we were to go that far. They don't even know where they are on a map. And when you start telling the American people that they are going to risk nuclear war over these 29, 30 countries we now have in NATO, not counting us, 29, I don't think too many of them are going to be cooperative. And let's look at what else we've done with Article 5. We've put NATO in Afghanistan. We put NATO in Iraq. We let NATO lead the military operations in Libya, which were a disaster, are still a disaster. How does Article 5 apply to that? So the most important component of the NATO alliance has been completely ignored, and I've not seen this in a single media source in America. I've seen it in a couple of foreign press articles, but not in America. No one's talking about it because they don't know what to do with it if they know anything about it in the first place. That's a real conundrum with regard to why would you want to do this? Why would you want to spread that kind of commitment, which is ultimately, in its most profound form, the willingness to risk nuclear war? Because both of us are still the most heavily equipped with nuclear weapons states on the face of the earth, Russia and us. Together, we had 60,000 weapons at the end of the Cold War. We're down to about 10,000 now combined, but that's still enough to obliterate us all. So enough to put nuclear winter across this planet for 5 years and we wouldn't be able to raise crops, we'd be through. And I don't know a sensible person in or out of the military who doesn't understand that if you go nuclear, you go all the way. There's no way you're going to control escalation if you start it. And that's what we're talking about again now too, based on this confrontation over Ukraine. Russian military doctrine now includes battlefield use of small-yield nuclear weapons. This hasn't occurred since the early 50s, when there were military people in both the Soviet Union and in the United States who believed they had utility. Most Americans don't realize that Dwight Eisenhower in the late 50s was actually talking to his military about using nuclear weapons against Mao Zedong when he was on the islands of Quemoy and Matsu, shelling them daily and looking like he was going to go on to Taiwan. With all that knowledge in the past and everyone having forgotten it, except people like me that teach it, we're back there with Putin and his general. The Russians have actually incorporated into their written military doctrine that if they have an incursion, and the only way they're going to have an incursion, and you read their doctrine, you know who they're talking about, is NATO. If they have an incursion into their near abroad or their territory, they are going to hit the points and the flanks of that incursion with nuclear weapons. You can't have it any more explicit than that. And of course, now we're talking about a new nuclear weapons development program, which I hope the nuclear posture review that President Biden is doing right now will kill. I can't tell you what'll happen in 2024 when we get a new president, but that doctrine was going to include our response, more tactical nuclear weapons, and we were going to put them on submarines, ballistic missile submarines, and counter the Russian nuclear weapons with those. Now, let me ask you, even as a layman, and I'm not a nuclear weapons expert, I was a prefix five officer, a nuclear officer, but I'm not an expert in them in the sense that some of these people are. But how do you differentiate if you're a Russian looking at a nuclear ballistic missile nuclear submarine opening its doors and getting ready to launch and launching? That's when you're going to pick it up for sure. How do you differentiate between a strategic launch and a tactical launch? You can't. So what do? You have a few minutes to react. It's pretty clear what you do. You react, and you react with a strategic launch of your own. This is very dangerous, what we're doing. How does that apply to Ukraine? Fast forward for a moment. As we began to expand NATO, and Putin in particular, but his military in general, began to get really, really worried about how close we were coming to their borders and what is comfortably their territory. I mean, Ukraine was a part of Russia since Catherine the Great. It got to be really serious in terms of Putin's language with us. And when we suggested, my president went to Georgia, he went to Tbilisi, Georgia, and suggested publicly with the Georgian president right beside him that Georgia would someday be a member of NATO. Well, we saw what Putin did there. Now he has about 25% of Georgia. He invaded it. And now we're talking about Ukraine, which is even more serious than Georgia, really, if you look at a map. And here's what I think we have discovered. I think we knew it quite along, but we now have suddenly discovered it for negotiating purposes. He really was concerned about. We are putting ballistic missile defense launchers all over Europe. And we're touting that they are for just that, ballistic missile defense. And usually we will say that they're for Iran. You know, we're for Iran. You know, they're not for you, Mr. Putin. They're for Iran. In case Iran were to shoot a missile, or North Korea for that matter, who's gaining range and range capacity every day. That's what we say publicly. Well, Mr. Putin, have some empathy, Mr. U.S. President. Have some empathy. Mr. Putin looks at that within 8 minutes flight time of Moscow and says, well, those are not necessarily ballistic missile defense launch platforms because I know what they're dual capable of. And he's absolutely right. They're capable of launching Tomahawk cruise missiles with a nuclear warhead on them, which we have. And so he's looking at maybe 8 to 10 seconds flight time before it gets into his bailiwick, big time. And nuclear weapons in your bailiwick are not comfortable. Compare it, if you will, to Khrushchev's attempt in 1962 to put missiles in Cuba and the change in strategic flight time for those missiles. I mean, you're talking about some really short ranges to hit some fairly big targets in the United States. And no one wanted to talk about a Yankee submarine, Soviet submarine sitting off Boston. Flight time into Washington from a Yankee submarine was about 18 seconds or something like that, sort of like a 9/11 situation. So that's what got Putin really energized and started moving these troops and so forth. What I think we're doing now, and this gives me some hope, I think they are now talking in ways that go something like this. Would you be satisfied if we agreed that for an indeterminate period, we won't put any BMD launchers in Ukraine? And maybe we might talk with you a little bit about the ones we've already put down in Poland, for example. That would probably get to the point where you could come to a deal. And then you go back to the Minsk agreement, which Putin has been asking to do all along. And you have provisions in the Minsk agreement that I would bring forward and adapt and make real, that would give you more or less what I call a studied neutrality. That is to say, Ukraine would be a neutral country. No one would covet it as a possessed, as a violation of their sovereignty, their state sovereignty. What could you do during that neutrality? You could do all the things you need to do. Ukraine has one of the most corrupt governments on the face of the earth. They cannot seem to get their act together with any political group or party. They need some time to figure out how to get rid of the old communists. They're still around. To get rid of the neo-Nazis, whom we are backing with our CIA, which is appalling. You can't find anybody to back that believes the same thing you do. Who really hates the Russians? Oh, these neo-Nazis. Oh, wonderful. Let's back them. That's the kind of thing we do in the world now, and don't tell the American people anything about it. But they would have this time of neutrality to get their act together politically, governmentally, corruption-wise, economically, financially. And maybe if the EU, Moscow and Washington primarily, but everyone really, Beijing too, just did nothing but help them with that as much as they can, whether it's financial help, economic help, advice and counsel, whatever, observers for their elections, those sorts of things, that would be a positive development, I think. And quit talking about being a member of anybody's alliance. Quit talking about all things military. Quit sending weapons in. I applauded the Germans on that broadcast that I did. I applauded them for saying we're not sending weapons and no one's transmitting weapons through our territory. Smart. The Germans are smart. So that's a solution that I see, and I hope we stumbled on it, and I hope that's what we're doing right now. That's what I'm hearing from my sources inside the Pentagon and the State Department, that we are finally beginning to talk realistically. My concern, deep concern, is that, and even the president, President Biden, has demonstrated this over the last 6 or 7 weeks from time to time, that the need to talk belligerently and principally because of politics, domestic politics, because somebody like Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or Lindsey Graham is going to jump up and accuse the president of being Neville Chamberlain, abandoning Czechoslovakia to the Nazis and all these other historical analogies that have no relevance whatsoever to today. I wish they'd put them all away. They're all irrelevant to today's circumstances. And to take counsel from those past events is to take counsel from nonsense. They aren't relevant to today. Appeasement's not relevant to today. What's relative today is that there are 750 million Europeans now who can't seem to get their act together politically, maybe not even economically anymore. Look at Brexit and Britain. Those 750 million people constitute, along with China, ourselves, India, and maybe some other possible condominium-like organizations in the world, the real power in the world today. Certainly the poles of that power are China and America. Russia is a capital with a gas station. If you really look at what Russia has in terms of cards in its hands, they're very slim. In fact, Putin is a master craftsman the way he's done what he's done and gotten the publicity he's gotten and kept himself in office through that publicity because he really doesn't have a whole lot of power other than nuclear weapons. People say, 200,000 Russian soldiers. Well, okay. I'll go back to my comments with the Reverend before we started. We put 165,000 troops in Iraq and we got our rear ends handed to us. I mean, we did. We did the same thing in Afghanistan, not quite as many troops, but we had to retreat with our tail between our legs. So number of troops doesn't mean anything anymore, especially when you've got people who are willing to wage guerrilla warfare against you until they die and their children die. You can't win those kind of wars, and anyone getting involved in them is just colossally stupid. That's the best way to put it. And I don't think Putin's stupid. I really don't. I hope he doesn't prove to me that I'm wrong and do something that would be colossally stupid, like invade Ukraine. So I never discount the possibility of human error and accident and fate. But I think we're at a point right now where diplomacy could prevail. And we could back down from the sort of edges we're all on right now. And I would see, as I said before, I would see, and I would do this if I were President Biden, I would see the Germans being able to play a sort of middleman in all of this to be very effective. Normally, I might say the French, but the French have been kind of here and there on this up to this point. The Germans have been very solid, very solid. And my experience with the Germans when we were doing the real feat of the late 20th century, and I mean that, George H.W. Bush created an absolute miracle along with Gorbachev and Shevardnadze when they brought Germany back together peacefully and kept it in NATO and kept Moscow mollified. That was an incredible feat that neither Gorbachev nor Bush, Shevardnadze, Baker, Bush's Secretary of State, and sort of get enough credit for. NATO's purpose for a soldier like me, the way we summed it up before the Cold War ended, was to keep Russia out, the Germans down, and the Americans in. That was it. That was the summary of our purpose in NATO. Think about that for a minute now. Why does NATO even exist now? Why do we need it now? Well, I think probably we need it for a few more years just to keep the transatlantic link from severing. Take you back to 1989 when I first joined Colin Powell in Atlanta at U.S. Forces Command. And we're talking about it, and he looks at me and he says, you know, all the leaders in Europe in a few years will not have their feet in the war. Now I knew what he meant. Helmut Kohl, Francois Mitterrand, Thatcher, Major, they'd all be gone. And he said, when that happens, when we get a crop of leaders in Europe, and then of course, you know, every leader after that will be the same, that don't remember the war, that don't have a memory, either as a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, 20-year-old, whatever, of that war and what America did for Europe in that, forget the transatlantic link. It will sever, tatter, break, and it'll be over. Well, that's Putin's number one objective right now. That's his number one strategic objective, is to separate the United States from Europe. Then to kill NATO, and separating the United States will do that, so he gets two for one in that. And then third, to make sure the European Union, 750 million people now, doesn't get its act together and become a competitor. Those are Putin's strategic goals. I just know those are his strategic goals. That's what I was trained as, a strategist. And he is a strategist par excellence. He's one of the best strategists in the world. And he's also got one of the finest foreign ministers in the world, Sergei Lavrov. Powell and he were like that on the cell phone every day, talking, resolving things. And, you know, the NSA said, you can't do that. You can't do that. That's classified information. Yeah. Powell and the Chinese foreign minister talked on cell phones too. Their objective was to stop the crisis before it happened, to get in there and talk, because talking was better than going to war. And the cell phones expedited that. And so to heck with the NSA, they talked. You may remember the April 10th crisis when the Chinese shot down a US reconnaissance plane that strayed too close to Hunan Island, and our plane had to go down on Hunan Island and the Chinese captured it. Powell was on the cell phone immediately with Chen Qichen, who was the Chinese man traveling with the Chinese leadership group at that time in South America, and who knew America better than anyone else. And before Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney could start a war, Powell had solved the crisis. I mean, that's how diplomacy's done today, by good people working fast. I'm sad to say we've kind of lost that skill. We need to get it back. We need to get it back quickly. And this is a crisis that I think could do that. It could grow us up a little bit. Some other things about it, though, that are less than savory. One is the fact that we don't know where to go from here with NATO. We don't want to back down in the sense that we lose faith. That's just an American trait. But at the same time, I think we're beginning to understand, and I'm almost positive President Biden understands this, the problem is domestic politics, which are torturous right now. And you can't show any ankle, especially with these people who come out and rail at you. And the New York Times and the Washington Post will pick up on it. They'll publish op-eds, pick up on it and go with the, he said this, he said that, the president looking weak and all this kind of stuff. When what they should be doing is doing their own in-depth analysis and doing some of the things I'm doing right here, right now, and saying, hey, look, at least half of this, if not more, and I think more, is our fault because of what we've done so ineptly and so non-strategically. But how do you back down from that? How do you get to the point, let's say we do calm the Ukraine waters and things are looking better and we come to some kind of agreement that's based primarily on this understanding that we're not going to put BMD launchers in Ukraine. How do we then say, well, what do we do with these 29 other countries? How do we deal with Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Montenegro, if something happens and they start it? Because that's the way these things really get out of hand is when some little, I'm going to say this, pipsqueak country decides that it's going to use Article 5 to cover it while it's doing something it shouldn't be doing. And the other side checks them. That's how you get led into a war. You don't get led into a war usually by the bigger countries like Germany or France. You get led in by some country that feels like it's got the protection now to do things, whether it's a Hungary, a Poland, one of the Baltic states or whatever. So every time you put somebody else in NATO, you increase your risk factor a little bit on that scale. And that may sound cold and hard, but that's the reality of power, especially power at this level. You don't need to be getting yourself into places where you really have no significant interest and nuclear weapons are involved. You just don't. Big arguments right now over Taiwan with that respect. 24 million people who basically are in a democracy with 1.4 billion over the top of them, armed to the teeth and wanting them. And we're standing in the way, so to speak. But is that really in the interest of the American people to risk nuclear war in a circumstance like that? Well, that's going to be a question we're going to have to answer in the next decade, probably, because Xi Jinping has made it quite clear that Taiwan is going to come back into China during his premiership. That's deadly.
That was Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Wilkerson works as Distinguished Adjunct Professor of Government and Public Policy at the College of William and Mary. You heard excerpts of a talk he gave on February 6, 2022 to the Coalition for Peace Action in Princeton, New Jersey. There are links to the speakers in this broadcast and the declassified documents in the National Securities Archives on TUC Radio's website. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.